Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcasts currently feature the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening.
Our reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, and I'll be reading verses 1 through 8. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, taking the spices that they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. The women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He's not here, but has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified, and on the third day rise again." And then they remembered his words.
When I go down to the river of Jordan, just to bathe my weary soul, if I can but touch the hem of his garment, good Lord, and then I know he'll make me whole. My
youngest, I have three kids. My youngest son, Isaac, likes to tell jokes. I'm not good at it. I've practiced all week, so let's hope. Because this week he got in the car after school, and he shared a joke. For him, it was about math, but I've been struggling with this sermon. So to me, it really felt like this joke could explain the difference that heaven makes. I think that's really what the joke was about. I think. He said this, and I'm just changing the word from math to heaven. Trying to understand heaven is like trying to smell the color 9. Just think about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I did too. I'm driving. Yeah. So, here's another way, not a joke, poetry. Heaven is invisible as music, but positive as sound. That about says it for me, and then I get all weepy. See? I'm going to do my best. I only have to do one out of four of these. So just to review where we've been, because we started this 2 weeks ago, this series on heaven, and we explored the differences in the way that heaven was imagined in the ancient world and the ways that it's commonly imagined in our day. And Matt helped us go through these understandings, the cosmology that heaven was above, hell was below, and there was a flat earth in between. Because that's what people thought back then. And then we reflected on how heaven is often exclusively imagined in our day, today, as the place one goes to when one dies. Yet the gospel testimony about heaven focuses most prominently on heaven as the origin of a reality that is coming at us in the present. In the present. And in the gospel testimony, we hear of heaven as the course of God's forthcoming. And it's created by God as a community. And we learned the word basileia, which is translated as kingdom, God's kingdom at hand. And then last week we were interested, Matt and I got really interested to learn from our kitchen tables. They met and talked about these things and sent us some of the samples of what the conversations were. We were interested in finding out that you can't actually have a conversation about heaven without moving straight to a conversation about hell. And what's interesting about that and fascinating is that there are 675 appearances in Scripture of the word heaven or something like the heavens, and there are actually no references to hell in the Hebrew Scriptures, and 12 that you can find in the New Testament. 675, 12, wow. And then Matt helped us to look more closely after that at all of these theologies of heaven. I think that's a slide, maybe. And he outlined them for us, and he shared where he mostly finds himself, which is in the promise of heaven that places primary focus on the Bible's apocalyptic and eschatological testimonies. He's smart, really smart, in a different way than I am. Heaven from this view is imagined as hope. So if faith depends on hope for its life, the sin of unbelief is manifestly grounded then in hopelessness. And our Christian faith then means that we tune into the nearness of God in which Jesus lived and worked. For living amid the simple everyday things of today is, of course, living in the fullness of time. That's what we do. And living in God's nearness to us. And to grasp the never-returning moment, to be wholly one with oneself, wholly self-possessed and on the mark, is what one in that view is meant by God. And since we are followers of the one who lived in that kind of closeness and proximity to God, then we too, by grace, may adopt this way of being and finding meaning. So that's where we've been for 2 weeks. And this week, we're going to reflect on the realities of heaven given the nuances of Scripture and tradition, keyword being reality, I hope. And then finally, we're going to, next week, wonder a little bit about how we might live in hope based on our own understandings, which we hope people are starting to work on, our own understandings of heaven. We don't expect people to all come down in one place or even come down where Matt is or Linda is. But we hope that people will be thinking and wondering, and we're doing that with you. So I'm going to go back to the word basileia. It's a word we learned it means kingdom of God, and it also has in its understanding, it's not an English word, that the kingdom is at hand. Basileia means the kingdom at hand. And that's where I'm going to try and begin today, with the at hand part. Another way to think of that word, at, those words at hand, is to think in the real world or in reality. And that sounds straightforward, maybe, but it isn't. And Karl Barth, Matt's favorite theologian, describes heaven as being this: inconceivable, incomparable, unimaginable, inaccessible, and indescribable. And then he proceeds to devote more than 400 pages doing that. I did not read all 400. 400 pages to describe the reality of heaven. So why do we worry about the reality of heaven? Why don't we just say heaven is a spiritual reality and stop there? We could just say that. Well, the Bible doesn't even do that. There's a one verse in Matthew 13, verse 11. It says, "He answered, 'To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, the basileia, but to them it has not been given.'" So we're supposed to grapple with this somehow. And we've been following a book by Christopher Morse called The Difference Heaven Makes. And Morse pushes into this when he says that if these so-called terms of heaven, the reality of heaven, don't conform to any of the terms or real factors of the world that are empirically verifiable or objectively cosmological or subjectively anthropological, I have to go slow to understand him, or a social construction, what sense does it make if it's none of those things to talk about it as reality? It kind of doesn't. At least it really never has to me. And that's where I always get myself in hot water. Because frankly, some of you who are out there sitting, and I'm not going to look at them, they're listening to me right now, and I've gotten in hot water with them. So if I'm looking at you, you're not one of them. Because when some folks talk to me about heaven or ask me about it, you know, they seem to me to be asking about something or some place that is literal. And the question of where is heaven is usually timed with the question of what happens when a person dies. And remember when Matt was talking last week, he was outlining a literal view, right, of heaven. And it means if you have a literal view of heaven, that context and reference don't matter. So the example he gave us was if you're going to climb Jacob's ladder, that's in Genesis 28:12, if you're going to climb Jacob's ladder, you would really be going up a step ladder. And from this view, the basileia of God coming from heaven to earth in order to displace the form of the world that is passing away would be equivalent to saying that a meteor is coming for us out of the sky to abolish the planet. So a literal view just has never made sense to me. So when this comes up, I try to ease into my answer by asking my own question. Well, what do you want to know? What are you asking me? I try it that way. And the answer is usually something like, I just want to know that the person who died is with, and they name another person that has already died long ago. And since context and reference do not matter in a literal view, when a person is upset and grieving a death, I try to be gentle, and then I give the great pastoral answer. Well, no one really knows exactly what happens when we die now, do we? Yeah, right. I got heels on. Because it doesn't often seem kind or timely to say the question of whether the person that you just lost has gone to sit in the lap of your grandmother who died 15 years ago really misses the mark of the gospel testimony of heaven. And heaven is a reference about living and about how God's reign will come to us in the midst of our living. And the dying is about how God will reorder the whole world and her power structures so that all means all. And justice and mercy is going to abound with love at the center. You don't want to hear that when you're upset. Timing is everything. Yet the question of what difference does heaven make is often exactly what is being asked when someone is physically dying. So when you don't answer that way that I just did, then I sort of feel like I'm lying. So let me try and say a little bit about that. I gotta drink some water. Matt has shared that in his family, he and Sarah have suffered the death of 4 grandparents in 1 year, and he let you know that my dad died 3 years ago. When death comes as a natural end to a fairly long life, like the great grandmother's, there is often a sense of this is how it is, right? And there really isn't much questioning about it by adults. But Eleanor is wondering about her great-grandma's. She's four. She's 4 years old. And when you're four, you're trying to put together your worldview. I don't know, none of us really maybe remember that, but that's what we do when we're 3 and 4 years old. And she's literally learning things like, I am here, and when mommy and daddy go in the next room, they're actually going in a room and they still exist to me. This is why babies cry like crying, because they think we're literally gone, right? It's why children can play peekaboo forever, because they are actually surprised. They are actually surprised every single time. Now think about how bored we get. They are not bored. It's why they like to play hide and seek. They're not actually sure they are going to find you. I know, but it's true. We all go through that developmental stage. And when I am asked about heaven by some people, it often feels to me like they're asking me if they are going to take their hands off their eyes someday and see the person that has died. But maybe I'm hearing it wrong. And maybe that's not what is really being asked of me. Maybe what they're really asking me is, please comfort me, Pastor, in the midst of my discomfort with the finality that death brings. Please say something that will make this less hard and horrid and painful. And to that I say like this, very little. Mostly I cry. I just sit there and cry. Or I try to be quiet. It's the only thing really I know to do. Because I've been there, and I know that feeling. And when a person is dead, they're dead. And I just have to say that. Because we're human beings and we die. And it's the feeling that you know that what you love is completely over and gone that like permeates you in that moment. And it's never going to return. And it's awful. And it makes me want to throw up, honestly. That's what it feels like to me. That's how bad it can be. And it makes a person sometimes not want to get out of bed. And sometimes it's so bad that it makes a person want to die themselves. Really. It is that gut-wrenching of a feeling. 3 days after my dad died, somebody knocked on my door. I was very proud. I had taken a shower and I got dressed. I opened the door and it was Matt with Eleanor. And they had not called first. Because he knows I would have said, no. And I opened the door and I looked at him and I said, well, I took a shower. And I got dressed. You remember what you said? Your shirt's on inside out. I know. We suck at pastoral care, I'm telling you. You know, I never thought of that. Maybe you should not have said that to me. No, because if I'd gone in public, I would have killed you. But that's the truth. It's true. So that's how it is. And I know that. But it's not like after that moment, like immediately happens, it's not like I live there. If I'm aware enough and I notice it, and I'm with people, I try to at least put a name to it, and I'm willing to be in the finality of death and something that ends, that is mysterious, before the next thing begins, or something that seems final as it's dovetailing into a new beginning. And I'm willing to be honest about the grief that often lingers and tinges every part of that new life that's next. I can do that. Because of the scripture that Matt read for us this morning. That's why I can do it. Because I've made Jesus' story my story. So usually then the next thing I do, just so you know, is then I pray somehow. And I pray something either out loud or in my head that says something like, let God's presence be made known to me, to this person, and to all of humanity. And those of you who kind of know me know I actually don't say it like that. I'm like, God, get your butt in here, because I am sitting here and this person needs you right now, and so do I. That's what it sounds like. That's okay. And then I think of something like, let God's reality arrive on the scene. And then I realize, there I am. God's reality arriving on the scene. Basileia, we're back at heaven in that moment. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, right? Christopher Morse says it this way. In the gospel testimony, heaven in this context of usage is most characteristically associated with the news of life that is said to be now coming towards us. And the church's prayer is that this kingdom come and that the will of heaven this day be done on earth like it is in heaven. That's as real as it can get. Understanding the heavenly coming of life now at hand in our everyday life. That's why the prayer questions in this room when we get to communion say, what does it mean to you to hear that heaven is now? It's difficult to understand. It's hard to grasp. It's hard to articulate. Believe me, it's really hard to name. So I'm going to go back to Karl Barth. Because frankly, because of those thousands of words he's written, two really finally worked for me. And those two words from Karl Barth were imagination and disbelief. When understanding escapes our ability to verify veracity, we have to go deeper and further, and this is where the artists and the poets and the storytellers enter the scene, thank God. Even Christopher Morse, in all of his academic, wordy brilliance, has to call upon the powers of the poet. In this case, Emily Dickinson. Same can be said of Jesus. Because when he's talking about the coming Basileia, or the kingdom of heaven, he uses parables, not lecture notes. He says, this is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing, they do not see, hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. Lecture notes don't get it. Stories, parables, get it. And just to be clear, parabolic significance involves the use of familiar terms, stuff that we know, to signify to the hearer something that feels unfamiliar to us. The parable brings significance beyond what is immediately evident from their everyday meaning, okay? We know what we know. Or at least we know what we think we know, right? And sometimes it's really necessary to put the books down and just talk and speak out of what we know. So that's what I'm going to do for a second. I know, you guys. Stay with me, please. I have 3 kids. I've given birth to 2 of them, and 1 is adopted, but I've nursed all 3. Before I was pregnant, I was me, okay? I had my body. I had my whole life. When I was pregnant, and when Isaac's birth mom was pregnant with him, and he's in the room, so I'm going to include him in that story, bodies change. My body changed. Both times, what was happening to the fetus that was growing inside of me became a baby, and that changed. They were changing slowly over 9 months. And then in a split moment, I gave birth, right? The first time my baby was cut out of me by C-section. That was a different way. The second time I gave birth regular, whatever the heck that means. And the third time I got to be on the receiving end and Mark cut the cord for Isaac. Every time that happened, in that instant, the me that I was before that baby came and breathed its first breath, the me that I was before that died. Gone. And I'm telling you, she is gone. Also, the baby that grew inside my body and Jenny's body ceased to be the way they were forever at the moment they came into being in a completely new way. And then, both of us, out of that, and I should have included Mark, but you don't have all day. Both of us, out of that dying, entered a whole new reality. Right? Now, there was no funeral for any of those deaths. But they were clearly deaths to me. Because I'll never be that way again. Ever. I'm never going to look the same. I don't care what you say about CrossFit. Mm-mm. I will never look the same. And now I'm a mother. And that's not the end. The mother I was at the moment they lifted Harrison, my firstborn, out of me is sure the heck not the mother I am to him 19 and a half years later. I had no idea. No idea. And I had no time to question it because it was coming, hurtling towards me. The kingdom of heaven is at hand right now, ready or not. Death to life at hand, soon, immediate, here, and then a coming unknown reality. That's the best way I know how to talk about it. And that's a metaphor, right? That's not even a parable. A parable about the kingdom of heaven takes something that I just told you that you totally understand, birth, I hope, you know, all of that process, and then turns it upside down. That's how Jesus taught. I'm just a normal person. Jesus taught in parables, so I'm going to try that from something he said. I'm going to use a fig tree, because we've done that in here before. Please tell me you know what a fig tree is. All right, this is good. There's a passage in the Bible where Jesus, talking about the kingdom of heaven, says, "From the fig tree, learn its lessons. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that heaven is near, at the very gates." So, you all know what it's like to see little buds on a plant. And you know the next season's on its way, right? I'm not a gardener, but I called Antonio yesterday. He told me it's true. Right. But then Jesus does this. Matthew 21. He's walking with the disciples. In the morning, when Jesus returned to the city, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree, this is the fig tree that he just said has its life in its season, right? Everything there is a season. And seeing a fig tree by the side of the road, he went to it, found nothing at all on it but leaves. And he said to it, "May no fruit ever come from you again." And the fig tree withered and died at once. Harsh. Confusing. He doesn't care about whether it is in season. Dude, it's not fig season. What's wrong with you? What is wrong? What's wrong with that story? See, we don't know because we didn't live back then. And we weren't sitting there next to the man named Jesus when he told it. People get really upset about this parable and Jesus because on the surface he's just being harsh. But if you go beneath it, what we completely miss is the deeper meaning that the right time, as far as living with Jesus is concerned, is completely reset. No more right time. You cannot even count on the seasons of the year as your calendar anymore. He expects everyone and everything to bear fruit all the time. No excuses. Don't tell me it's out of season. It's summer. I'm not going to go to church. No. Right? See how that flipped over? Karl Barth, one more time. It's only by becoming parabolically likened in this manner, as reflected in a natural thing like a fig tree and the processes of earth, that you can start to recognize what Jesus means by heaven on earth being real in the cosmic sense, as the kingdom of God can be known, or you can miss it because you don't know what the heck he's talking about. You can know it in these parables, or you can miss it. That's why he's always saying, "Let those who have ears hear." He knows we're missing it. So Emily Dickinson, the poet, her attempt at this very same teaching sounds different than a parable, but I think it still challenges our ears to hear it, like Isaac's joke. She wrote a poem called "The World Is Not Conclusion." Maybe some of you have heard it. To me, this is way easier to understand than Karl Barth. The world is not conclusion. A species stands beyond, invisible as music, but positive as sound. It beckons and it baffles. Philosophy don't know. And through a riddle, at the last, sagacity must go. To guess it, puzzles scholars. To gain it, men have borne contempt of generations and crucifixion shown. Faith slips and laughs and rallies, blushes if any see, plucks at a twig of evidence, and asks a vain the way. Much gesture from the pulpit, strong hallelujahs roll. Narcotics cannot still the tooth that nibbles at the soul. Plucks at a twig of evidence. When you go to pray today, there's twigs of evidence in our prayer stations. No, I'm not ready. Sorry. Twigs of evidence. See what happens when you pluck them. also checked with Antonio. This is Rosemary. It's dead. Okay? It's not alive anymore. He assured me of this. When you take it off the plant, it dies. But, go ahead, pluck at a twig of evidence after you take communion and see what happens. That other phrase that captured me in that is nibbles at the soul. Nibbles. That sounds timid to me. Maybe even a little gentle. But the way we have actually challenged the reality of heaven is anything but that, because that's the other phrase she has, crucifixion shown. That's what actually we do. Because our human condition is most often this, that out of our own fear of death, we resist the reality of heaven. We don't want to pluck. We don't want to pluck. We want to crucify. That's where we end up. We move away from it naturally often instead of towards it. That's why I cry when I try and talk about it, because it takes everything in me to go towards it. The news of the gospel announces a deadly opposition, though. That's what Matt read. To what comes from heaven is made plain by the message of crucifixion. We try to kill it, but he read for us our witness. They went to the tomb and, surprise. If ever there was a moment that one might have actually been ready to meet death, they were running there to meet it. And those first witnesses, they don't have everything we have. They're back in the hospital waiting room, right? And they just got news that their loved one died. Grief, devastation, maybe they're even resigned. He's gone. I saw it, you saw it, he's in the tomb. And they get there, and the stone isn't where it's supposed to be. And suddenly, what was it he said to us? That was the end. Remember what he said to us. And I imagine they're going, what was it about that fig tree? I knew I should have written that down. I knew I should have remembered that. And can I now hope that what he said about the fig tree is going to be true about him and me? See, they were already turning away from death. When we are with death, we know it's real, but we don't have to stay there. The question is whether our faith has grown deep enough to share our witness, you see, that the resurrection of Jesus makes a difference to us about how we manage those things and live with them. Just as those folks did on that very day, we're the same. So, I'm almost done. I shared a bit of my story and told you about parables and read a poem. It is noteworthy to me that this man, Christopher Morse, this is his book, put this on the cover of it as an abstract painting. Not a whole bunch of words explaining. Those are inside. Abstract art does not depict a person, a place, or a thing in the natural world. That's a definition for you of abstract art. It's why people get pissed off at it. I have it all around my house. That's not going to surprise you to know. Abstract art, even in an extremely distorted or exaggerated way, is really not meant to represent anything we actually see, like a fig tree. This is a painting by Robert Weatherford, and what I love about this artist that I researched is this man has a master's degree in systematic theology from the, is it from your place? Yeah. He's smart. Union. That man has studied Jesus. Look at that. So like the reality of heaven, abstract art refuses definitions that are hard and insists on experience lived within one's days to interact with it. So of this painting, you may ask, what is it? But you're not going to get an answer. You would do better to wonder, to where do I feel transported by these colors? What direction are the strokes moving, and what direction am I moving? Like the color in this painting, heaven is coming at us at this very moment. It's hurtling through time and story and parable and color and understanding and heart and soul to sweep us up in its wake. In its wake of frothing, foaming love and passion for how we live today. Those are my kind of words. I wrote that part. It's right now, and for me, heaven is my weeping at the moments of grace that I witness. Heaven is the miracle of ministry. As we, Matt and I, companion people, and as your kitchen leaders, table leaders, and you all companion each other and witness each other's lives. It's when we get an email that says, "Dear Pastor Linda, God didn't reject me. The church is messed up and the people are rude, but God seems fairly open to homosexuality as far as I can tell. But I've been mad at God." Heaven is the disbelief that reaching in love will ever make any real difference. The disbelief in that. But we still organize and fundraise and get those backpacks on the backs of those babies who have no home, no schedule, no adults other than all of us and a few teachers. Heaven is the disbelief that we are all on our own and that we are in charge. If you think I didn't make a plan with Matt to come up here and read this, you're wrong. I didn't know if I could get through it. I have to know. I asked the music team, please stay in the room. We're not on our own. That's where heaven is real to me. And the part that death plays in it is crucial. If by death we mean the dying of our own fear and the dying of our own resistance to saying that we know what we know to be true, and the dying of our silence in the face of places we need to speak up. And it's located in the moments that we have the courage to say yes to loving and being loved. And heaven is encountered when we live into the promise of what is before us and allow that to define us. Allow that to define us more than the crap that has been. It's realized as we persevere in the midst of our suffering and grieving for an at yet unrealized joy that I know is out there. Now, so we're going to move to this table. Thank you for staying with me. And we're going to do this thing we've done forever, which is break bread. And I hope that we can wonder together more about how the reality of heaven might shape our lives today and every day as we recognize whatever it is in our lives that is passing away. And whatever is coming into being, which is invisible as music, but you hear it, it's positive as that sound.
Jesus' life became a parable, and it's that parable that we gather around now to touch and to taste the hope that lives within one who said, do this in remembrance of me. And so we turn to that ancient parable, to Jesus who becomes parable, as we gather around this table confessing our frailties before God and each other.
You are the hand that reaches out to save, and I am set free, oh, oh, oh. I am set free, oh, oh. It is for freedom that I am set free, and I am set free, oh, oh, oh. I am set free. Oh, oh, it is for freedom that I am set free. And yes, sir, I am grateful for your grace and for your love. And yes, Lord,